In Mexico, whether a business owner or a farmer, standing up to powerful drug cartels can lead to violent reprisals.
They can be kidnapped, their farms burned down, they can be killed, all the land can just be simply taken.
I'm Marco Werman. How organized crime in Mexico is terrorizing anyone who dares to oppose it. Also today, the U.S. exports more guns than any other country. A bipartisan effort in Washington to document when those guns are part of human rights violations is taken offline.
Cut off without any information or any alternative is really frustrating.
And international travelers caught up in the shutdown chaos at U.S. airports.
How am I going to get back if this is going to go on?
Yeah.
Next spring, maybe.
At least she's not too stressed out. All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It is good to be with you this Friday. In Mexico, part of what makes organized crime so hard to stop is that simply trying to stand up against it can turn into a death sentence. In recent weeks, two high-profile figures in the state of Michoacán were assassinated. One was a farmer, the other a politician. They both had spoken out against the drug cartels. The World's TBS Isaiah starts us off today with this report on what looks like a new reign of terror being carried out by organized crime gangs.
Last week in the city of Uruapan in Michoacán, families filled a plaza for a Day of the Dead celebration with lots of music, flowers, and dancing. The mayor, Carlos Manso, walked onto the stage holding his toddler in his arms. A video posted on social media shows him with his trademark cowboy hat, saying how happy he was to be there. Minutes later, he handed off his son. And he was shot to death in the middle of the plaza. Manso was one of the most outspoken anti-cartel politicians in Mexico, demanding that authorities kill armed cartel members. That defiance made him popular, but it also forced him to wear a bulletproof vest and travel with armed guards. His assassination shocked the country, but he wasn't the only target. Just days earlier, in the same area, Bernardo Bravo, a prominent farmer in Michoacán, was also killed.
Compañeras y compañeros productores, ¿cómo están? Buenas tardes. Saludarles a todos con mucho respeto.
In his last public video, he urged other lemon producers to stop paying extortion fees to criminal groups. 3 days later, he was found dead inside his truck. These assassinations sent a message. Speaking up in Mexico can get you killed. He was the fifth lemon producer murdered this year in Mexico. Security analyst Eduardo Guerrero says cartels in Michoacán compete over control of the agricultural sector.
Todos los productores agrícolas en el estado, todos, yo diría que sin excepción, son extorsionados.
He says all agricultural producers in Michoacán are being extorted without exception. Guerrero explains that it works like a criminal tax. Farmers pay a percentage of everything they produce. Limes, avocados, mangos, berries. And if someone refuses to pay,
incendian las bodegas donde está el producto, cortan, por ejemplo, los árboles de limón.
They burn warehouses, cut down lime trees with electric saws, and shoot at homes. It's a sophisticated business, says Chris Dalby, author of a book on Mexican cartels. He says local authorities are forced to cooperate with criminal groups.
Giving them access to state databases, for example, so they can find out exactly how many avocados each farmer has, or how many cattle each rancher has, or how much money each factory or each shop is making, so that they can then base their extortion figures on that.
Dalby says the impact of this extortion reaches consumers through inflated prices.
We've seen spikes of up to 50% in past years on lime and avocados. At high moments of extortion, at moments in which the industry feels under pressure, that price is obviously going to be passed on to the consumer.
President Claudia Sheinbaum has conducted an aggressive anti-cartel campaign during her first year in office. Her administration says it's arrested tens of thousands of suspects, destroyed more than 1,000 drug labs, and reduced the homicide rate. But this year alone, there have been more than 100 political assassinations in Mexico, plus killings of police, journalists, and musicians. This week, President Sheinbaum announced a new security plan for Michoacán.
Quisiera presentarles el Plan Michoacán por la paz y la justicia.
It involves more federal forces, a special prosecutor focused on extortion, and permanent federal offices in the most violent municipalities. But Giovanna Rios, who researches violence in Mexico at the Jesuit University of Guadalajara, says these moves are coming too late.
Entonces, la impresión es que vamos muy tarde, de que propongo.
She says these actions shouldn't be proposals. They should already be public policy, not only for Michoacán, but for all of Mexico. President Sheinbaum remains popular, even though polls reveal that many Mexicans believe violence is actually getting worse. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
Staying in Mexico for a moment, a disturbing incident from earlier this week continues to play out. President Claudia Sheinbaum was groped on the street by a drunken man. In a widely distributed video, you can see the man approach Sheinbaum. He then presses his body against hers, tries to give her a kiss while his hand starts to grope. The president filed charges against him to call attention to the problem of sexual harassment, which she says all women in the country experience. On Thursday, Sheinbaum presented a plan to get every state in Mexico to label sexual abuse as a crime. Flower vendor Melissa Escutia says it's remarkable that there's even a need for such laws. Even a president isn't free from the harassment that we women face every day, she says. Why can't men just control themselves? As troubling as the incident is, President Sheinbaum's critics say she's using it as a distraction. They say the political violence that we just heard about from our Latin America correspondent should take priority. The Kyoto Protocol of 1997 was a pretty big deal, the first international treaty to acknowledge that climate change is real. It also set targets to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. What the Kyoto Protocol managed to accomplish in almost 30 years, though, that is up for debate. Now there is a theatrical production inspired by what happened in Kyoto. It's focused on the drama in the room where that document was crafted. After premiering to rave reviews last year in England, Kyoto is now on stage at New York's Lincoln Center. Jeff London has our story.
The week I spoke with some of the creators of Kyoto, Hurricane Melissa had devastated Jamaica and Cuba, and New York had a short but deadly storm where two people were killed in flash floods. 28 years after the Kyoto Protocol, the crucial questions being addressed are urgent and still unresolved. Yet the United States is planning to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement, one of the follow-ups to the Kyoto Protocol. Stephen Daldry, who co-directs the play, says it's frustrating.
Where the science is so obviously very, very clear and established, it's obviously very odd to hear politicians from whatever country talk about anything to do with climate denial when it is obviously and has been without question established as a fact and as a climate emergency around the world.
Wrestle this process into an agreement for the sake of your children and mine.
The developed world must make
this play is set in the conference rooms where over 150 delegates from around the globe attempted, over a 10-year period, to come to consensus about setting legally binding targets to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And the real nitty-gritty is in the tense arguments and compromise needed to get a document that everyone could sign, says Joe Murphy, who co-authored the play with Joe Robertson.
The intention wasn't to write about climate change. It was actually to try and tell a story about polarization, about those divisions that really run through our societies at the moment that feel so intractable.
The two authors embarked on a 3-year journey researching the road to Kyoto, and Murphy says they fell in love with UN climate negotiations.
Which doesn't sound like the most conventional ingredients for a thrilling night at the theater, but in the people we spoke to, you know, scores of diplomats and delegates and scientists, we just found this amazing devotion and commitment and dedication to the craft of multilateral negotiations and a huge amount of emotion and pride. And we just went, how can we bottle this and put it on a stage?
Self-professed wonks, Robertson and Murphy discovered that a big part of the negotiating process centers around language.
We strongly support this amendment, comma, bringing out, comma, as it does, comma, rules for equitable allocation of entitlements, full stop, underscore, close brackets.
I think this is broken.
There are questions about brackets, conditional tense, commas.
As a writer, a comma is used to create clarity for a reader. But in climate law, a comma can be used to create ambiguity because its placement between clauses or the absence of a comma between clauses can create enough ambiguity that two separate parties, or two separate countries, are able to go back to their own governments and claim victory.
But every argument about a comma can contain the fate of an island nation facing rising sea levels, and the play puts the audience right in the middle of the action.
The set is designed as a sort of UN table, a bit like the Security Council or the General Assembly. You know, it's this circular table with microphones and headphones for the interpretation. And we wanted to invite audiences to take a seat at the table.
And at that seat, they come face to face with a man who's both the anti-hero of the play and, one could argue, the Kyoto Protocol. Don Perlman is a little-known lawyer who worked in President Reagan's energy department and, as an oil lobbyist, does everything he can to throw sand in the gears.
Don is such a useful foil.
Co-director Justin Martin.
What I love is the moments of the show in which he reflects us back to ourselves, because he does make you think about our own carbon footprint and our own contradictions.
Angela Merkel flies 5,600 miles from Berlin Tegel Airport, releasing 2.7 tons of carbon dioxide.
Merkel? Doctor.
Doctor?
Followed closely on the tarmac by Britain's new deputy prime minister, Mr. John Prescott.
And the unexpected lead negotiator for the whole of the bloody European Union.
What? Him?
Yes,
Stephen Kunkin plays Don. He says while he may not agree with his positions, he spent a lot of time talking with Don's son to prepare for the role.
One of the beauties about performing a character is the kind of getting inside of that person. And not judging them, but trying to find the connective tissue to that person.
At the other end of the spectrum is Raul Estrada, the Argentinian ambassador who becomes the chair of the annual UN Climate Conference. He believes in the science and insists on keeping everyone at the table, even if it means working overnight without translators. The actor who plays Estrada, Jorge Bosch, pays tribute to him at every performance, says co-author Joe Murphy.
He wears his tie on stage, the actual tie that Estrada wore in Kyoto, and that's his little nod to the real man behind the character.
Even though the show has been building to an agreement which the audience already knows, it's still a shock and relief when they come to consensus. Some have considered the Kyoto Protocol a failure. The U.S. Senate didn't ratify it, and other countries followed suit. But Murphy says that, in retrospect, the ability for the world's countries to come together for a moment, even if it didn't last, is a goal worth striving for.
We hope Kyoto shows how that is still possible. You know, multilateralism isn't dead. You know, it's about the will to agree and the will to move forward and to make the difficult compromises. So I feel hopeful, and that might be a weird thing to say.
If this doesn't feel like a satisfying ending, no worries. Murphy and Robertson say this is the first play in a trilogy to include the Paris Accords. For The World, I'm Jeff London, New York.
There's an online portal for documenting human rights abuses committed with weapons supplied by the U.S. government. Or at least, there was. That story's just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. sells weapons to armies and security forces in many parts of the world. It is the biggest arms exporter in the world by far. There's also a law that requires Washington to make sure that those arms do not go into the hands of people committing human rights violations. That law, named after Senator Patrick Leahy, also requires the U.S. government to make it easier for the public to report instances where they think the law has been broken. To that end, in 2022, the State Department launched a website that allowed the public to submit reports. But earlier this year, the site was quietly shut down. The World's Shirin Jafari has been digging into this for us and has some new details. So when you go to the website today, Shirin, what do you see?
So, Marco, when I tried to reach the website today, what I got was a blank page with an error message saying that the site can't be reached. The site, which is called the Human Rights Reporting Gateway, kind of a mouthful. But this is also something that Amanda Klessing noticed months ago when she was trying to reach the website. She's the National Director of Government Relations and Advocacy at Amnesty International USA. She told me initially she thought it was a temporary glitch.
Is this a technical problem? Is this intentional? Where should we actually be submitting this information now? And we haven't gotten that answer directly, but our understanding is that it was an intentional removal of the website.
Marco, I have been able to confirm that the site has in fact been taken down by the State Department.
So let's get deeper into what the site was for and what the goal of this gateway, as it's called, actually was.
Sure. So the website was a long time in the making, and the goal of it was to make it easier for the public to submit reports of possible gross human rights violations committed by foreign forces using American-made arms. Now, gross violations of human rights, what do we mean by that? Torture, murder, arbitrary detention, things of that nature.
And who would be able to submit those reports to the website?
Anyone, but particularly human rights groups, advocates, journalists, and anyone who has some sort of information about possible misuse of American-made arms. You go to the site, you can upload information. The form would ask you questions. For example, where did you see this violation take place? And what kind of evidence do you have that this violation took place? The good thing about the portal, Marco, was that people could submit cases anonymously. The experts that I have been talking to told me that this was important because often people making the reports live in war zones or, you know, they have some sort of threats against them coming forward and submitting these kinds of reports. And this website, this portal, made it possible for them to file these claims without putting themselves at risk of retribution.
Right. So what would happen to that information?
So the next step after that was that officials at the State Department would take that report and decide whether it warrants further investigation. If they were able to find out that there was, in fact, misuse of American arms, they could push ahead and ask for the arms sales to that military force be stopped or paused.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a very beneficial system for keeping an eye on these weapons. What have you been able to find out about why this website was taken down?
So there hasn't been any public explanation. And in fact, people who follow this very closely, they're surprised and they say they're left in the dark. I reached out to the State Department today and I didn't get any explanation about why the website was shut down. But an official sent a comment saying that the department, quote, abides by its legal requirements. Now, Amanda Klessing of Amnesty International told me that the closing of this website comes at a time when the State Department has laid off human rights experts and closed down offices. So there's a vacuum when it comes to the issue of human rights at the State Department now.
Shirin, I'm wondering if there are other ways that people can now submit reports without this website. And ultimately, what is the concern?
Yes, people outside the U.S. can go to U.S. embassies and find reports, or if they know someone who has connections at the State Department or these embassies, they can find reports. But this is how Charles Blaha put it to me about the, you know, the consequences of losing that avenue, the website. Blaha used to head the office that was in charge of implementing the Leahy Law when he was at the State Department. He spent about 3 decades at the State Department. He now works for an advocacy group called Dawn. He said that his concern with the elimination of the human rights reporting gateway is that the U.S. government could miss reports that it should be seeing.
The real value of the human rights reporting gateway is its availability to people in conflict zones. A lot of times, those people can't come to the U.S. embassies, and they're in danger if they file reports. And also, local human rights organizations are in the same bucket.
Amanda Klesing of Amnesty International also has concerns about this website going away.
It's devastating to see, you know, efforts that have built up over time, efforts that have been bipartisan, be just cut off without any information is really frustrating.
Marco, I should add a final point that there are concerns about U.S.-made arms being used in foreign conflict zones in places like Gaza, and this is just one less way to document and report possible misuse of these arms.
The World, Shirin Jafari, thank you very much for bringing us up to date on this news on U.S. weapons overseas.
You're welcome.
Despite the fact that international flights coming into the U.S. are not part of the current reduction by the Federal Aviation Administration, the longest ever U.S. government shutdown is still creating problems for international travelers. As you've heard, airlines today started cutting down the number of flights at some of the busiest airports in the country. The FAA ordered the changes in an effort to ease the burden on air traffic controllers. They've been working without pay for weeks now. Airline officials say the cuts mostly steered clear of international routes, but plenty of passengers flying abroad still have to make connections here at U.S. airports. Patricia Andeweg is from Australia and lives in Rhode Island. This week, she was planning to head from Boston to Brisbane to celebrate her birthday with family. She told our transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel this morning that her connecting flight through San Francisco was canceled, so Patricia had to change her plans.
By the time I get there, the birthday celebrations are all over. And how am I going to get back if this is going to go on?
Yeah.
So I say goodbye next spring, maybe, when it's better. But I'm so sorry, of course, to miss my 90th birthday.
Oh, my gosh. Your 90th birthday, you said?
Yeah.
Still, Patricia says she's keeping a positive attitude. Airline employees and the airport workers who pushed her through the terminal in her wheelchair, she says, were delightful.
I'm missing my birthday, but on the other hand, I met so many helpful people, right, left and center. So, you know, people are nice. I call it the journey to nowhere.
Other international travelers have been luckier. Hester Jean was heading to Jamaica this morning. She said her flight was delayed 30 minutes, but not canceled. Still, Jean was concerned that even if she made it to Jamaica with no trouble, the shutdown-related chaos could leave her stranded.
Am I going to be stuck where I am? Because usually when I travel, it's like really short. So I need to make sure I can get on those flights and back because I'm like going to work. So I don't want to miss my flight.
The airlines say they're phasing in-flight reductions gradually, but the number of cancellations and the number of international travelers stranded in the U.S. are still expected to grow in the days ahead. You're with the World. This is the World. I'm Marco Werman. Folks who've been through it know that fertility treatment can be expensive and time-consuming. In Britain, employees going through in vitro or other fertility procedures must use their personal or vacation time. One member of parliament from the Labour Party wants to change that. Alice MacDonald introduced a new bill this week proposing that paid time off for fertility treatment should be enshrined into British law. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry tells us more.
When Claire Ingall, a HR manager from Wales, was going through her first two rounds of IVF, she told almost no one.
Even my closest family, my parents didn't know, my sister didn't know, so this was something that I was quite ashamed of.
Ingall also kept it hidden from her employer, the National Health Service in England. When her second round of IVF failed, she was heartbroken.
I just was overwhelmed with the whole process, with the anger and the disappointment about not being able to conceive and thinking, is this my life now? Am I going to have to navigate a life without children when I'd imagined it for such a long time? And I myself took time off sick.
Ingall took 6 weeks off sick. She told her boss, though, she was suffering from anxiety and depression over something that was happening at home. By the time she went through her third round of IVF, she decided to speak up. She wanted her employer to understand the many appointments she might have to attend and the possible side effects of the treatment she might suffer that could take her out of work for a few weeks. For Rose, a physiotherapist in London who's just gone through her second round of IVF, the only option was to reduce her hours at work.
It was a big decision to make because obviously, you know, we were hoping that eventually we would get pregnant, and obviously maternity pay is a really important thing to factor in. But I just got to the point when I was like, I just can't do it anymore. It's too stressful. And I just felt like I was burning out.
Rose, who doesn't want to give her full name for privacy reasons, says she did tell her boss and they've been relatively supportive. Her second round of IVF was successful. Still, she says, if she'd been entitled to paid leave, maybe she'd have stuck to working full time. Claire Ingle says this is something she hears all the time. Ingle has since co-founded an organisation called Fertility Matters at Work. The British Chambers of Commerce declined my request for an interview this week, but told the BBC its members worry about over-legislation when it comes to employee rights laws like these, which it said can create unnecessary burdens on businesses. It's often easier to sort these issues out on a case-by-case ad hoc basis, the Chamber said. Ingle says that rarely works out well for the workers.
Do you know what? I actually think that that comment comes from a place of ignorance. And it's ignorance because people don't talk about it. But we can't leave this to luck of the draw.
There needs to be legislation so that all businesses are compelled to respect workers' rights, she says. Policies around fertility leave differ across Europe. In France, a new law introduced this summer grants paid time off to those undergoing treatment. In Malta, couples are entitled to 100 hours of shared leave. But in Britain, fertility treatment is considered the same as cosmetic surgery, says Labour MP Alice MacDonald.
In fact, the Equality Act Code of Practice on Employment makes a comparison between a woman having fertility treatment and a man having cosmetic dental surgery. How can that be right? Because let's be clear, fertility treatment is not a lifestyle choice. It is a necessity for so many people.
One in six heterosexual couples are affected by infertility in Britain, while women in same-sex relationships, as well as single parents using a donor, rely on fertility treatments to conceive. MacDonald tells me her new bill wouldn't just help those going through treatment. Employers will benefit in the long run too, she says.
You kind of know that up to 63% of people undergoing this treatment take sick leave, that they feel that's the only option they've got. And actually, you can't plan that if you're an employer, whereas if you felt you could have this conversation in the open, that you knew it was your right under law, you can actually plan that much better with your employer. So it makes business sense as well.
Getting the bill passed, though, will take time. Still, MacDonald says just having this conversation in Parliament is a big step forward. Now, she says, we need more business leaders to step up too. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
That cliche about all roads leading to Rome, it's actually more true than we ever knew. New research has found that the ancient Roman road network was twice the size than previously thought. We now know it stretched for nearly 186,000 miles in total. For comparison, that's 20,000 more miles of road than today's highway system in the United States. Tom Brookmans is a professor of classical archaeology at Aarhus University in Denmark and one of the lead researchers behind this discovery. I asked him to start by explaining just how big the Roman Empire was around 2,000 years ago.
The Roman Empire had the size of half of the present-day United States, and it covers about 30 present-day countries. It covers most of southern and western Europe, as well as all of North Africa and the Middle East. The Roman Empire and its roads are really a fundamental topic to understand many phenomena that happened then that are still important today. Things like early Christianity, its spread and development, that happened during the Roman Empire. There were massive pandemics that raged through this continental scale empire, but we also have mass migrations of Germanic peoples that contributed to the fall of the Western Roman Empire. These were phenomena that happened during Roman times, but that shaped human history in the region for the next 2,000 years.
And this understanding now of this much more expanded road network, does it give you new insight into how the Roman Empire worked or the power it wielded?
What I find incredibly fascinating is that the roads go absolutely everywhere. Our map reveals that the network was much denser in many parts of the empire than previously thought, meaning that a much larger percentage of the population could reach news, but also could be reached by infectious disease over these roads, for example.
How did you discover, Tom, that Romans built so many more roadways than experts realized?
Well, we've really drawn on not just 200 years of research in Roman roads, but the last atlas was actually made 25 years ago. So a lot has happened since then. But the main reason for the increase is also that the previous atlas wasn't particularly spatially detailed. Like when there would be a mountain, it would just go straight through it. And obviously, that's not how roads work. They would zigzag up the mountain and down the mountain. It took us 5 years and a large international team of experts in every part of the Roman Empire to digitize it, but also to connect it up across the entire empire. So we present the first digital atlas that respects that the friction of topography.
So today, how much of this ancient Roman road network is still intact, like what you can actually see?
There are definitely parts of the Roman road network that can still be seen and visited today. The Via Appia, or the Appian Way, that's a very enigmatic road in the south of Rome, where you can see these paved slabs and beautiful cypress trees along it, as well as graves. But it's really a tiny minority of roads that we can still see today. And that was one of our major challenges. You know, no one excavates entire roads. They are very long linear features through the landscape. And that's just not how archaeology works. We focus on point locations like where the Romans worked or lived, the settlements, the villas, the farms. And so the roads, we only see glimpses of them when development, for example, leads to excavation where we see a road underneath where the development is going to be. And that was a huge challenge. How do we connect up those dots of the glimpses of Roman roads on this continental scale empire?
So talk about that. You funneled all this information into a new digital map. Describe that map. What does it look like and how it works?
Our new digital map, you can go there yourself on itinerary.org and zoom in and you'll see the roads wiggling. One of those things that we know about Roman roads, or that we think we knew about Roman roads, is that they are all straight. But actually, thanks to our map, we are able to analyze quantitatively with data for the first time exactly how straight those Roman roads are. And you'll see for yourself when you explore our map, they are very wiggly. They're only straight in places where they're able to be straight, like flat landscapes, for example. It's kind of a Google Maps of the Roman world, if you will. So if you want to know how to travel from Cologne in Germany to Rome in Italy over the Alps using a donkey, you can do that on our platform.
And how do you know that these new routes you've identified were actually Roman and not something else?
That is a major challenge. So the amount of temporal information that we have available to us about when those roads were built, when perhaps new resurfacing investments were made, and when they stopped being built is extremely fragmentary. We know about some roads, when they were built and when they were resurfaced, but not for all the roads of the Roman Empire. What we've done is created a data set that can grow, a place where we can record that information about when they were built and became disused as that information becomes available. That's a huge area for growth in my field.
As I mentioned, your research doubles the known road network the Romans had. Give us some geography here. Do these roads go into new places or territories we did not know about?
The previous atlas covered the same territory. It's a huge area. But what we've managed to do is to increase the density almost across the board in the entire continental scale empire. There's a couple of areas where we made significant gains, like the Iberian Peninsula, northern France, and Egypt and Greece, for example. A lot of that, on the one hand, is because of new research that only has been performed or became available in the last 25 years. But another reason for that is that we have
in addition to the main roads, the named roads that have attracted a lot of research attention in the last 200 years, we've also focused on the Roman country lanes, if you will, the smaller roads, the secondary roads. Because what we feel is that Roman roads are just places where Romans walked. We want to understand how humans moved over land in this continental scale area 2,000 years ago. Think about it this way. If you want to understand mobility in the US and you've only got access to a data set of highways, that doesn't tell you anything. You wouldn't be able to figure out how people got to their own homes. Right. We need to know where the small roads are as well.
The Roman Empire was powerful, so they could do this. But why did the Romans build so many roads? Was it about commerce or unifying people in rural areas with the capital?
The Romans didn't build all the roads in the Roman Empire. They conquered this continental scale area. And what they did is they took the roads that were in these individual regions and for the very first time connected it up. It's the first empire that had a connected, integrated transport infrastructure on a continental scale. That is an invention we really have to grant the Romans.
Did the Roman Empire make technological advances in road construction?
Absolutely. The most impressive one would be the invention of Roman concrete, which enables, for the case of terrestrial transport, the creation of bridges, for example, and viaducts with these impressive curved arches. And that is really something that has made certain areas that are landlocked and with high topographical variation accessible for the very first time with major road transport.
Yeah, I mean, the Forum in Rome, for anybody who's been there, it has avenues that are concrete or stone. Would that have been the quality throughout this entire network?
Absolutely not. Roman roads weren't always paved. They weren't always fantastic, impressive infrastructure projects. Roman roads are places where Romans walked. If you are in the desert, and the Roman Empire spread throughout all of North Africa, there's a lot of desert in the Roman Empire, then it doesn't make any sense to pave a road. One sandstorm and all of your work would be for naught. In deserts, for example, you would take a camel and the camel would follow a very wide track, perhaps with some stones along its sides. And many of these roads in the Roman Empire were also more secondary tracks like country lanes, so they wouldn't necessarily be paved. It's really only in places where vast numbers of people needed to move very efficiently between places that can expect a lot of traffic, places where the Roman army would need to go for logistical reasons and for their supplies, or places very close by major population centers like the city of Rome. You know, you want to pave the major roads going into the big cities to enable that traffic flow in and out of your city to be efficient.
I'm speaking with Professor of Classical Archaeology Tom Broekmans about the extensive ancient network of roads in the Roman Empire. So coming back, Tom, to how you put together this research, I understand you didn't just use historical records from the Romans to track these routes. You also used aerial photographs from World War II bombers. Tell me about those images, how you found them and how you use them to identify Roman roads.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible how much information we have available to us taken from the skies, like you said, from airplanes during war scenarios, but also very early satellite missions. What is very valuable about those is that they show us a moment before a lot of the development and urbanization happened in the Roman Empire. So we can almost go back in time by looking at those photos and satellite images. We can strip away, for example, the water of a dam lake to see what the roads looked like underneath that are now covered by meters of water.
So as you were tracking these newly discovered routes, did you come across any big surprises?
The biggest surprise that our research revealed is that the Roman Empire's road network is 300,000 kilometers. That's more than seven times around the Earth. That's just really hard to get your head around. We weren't expecting this at all. The previous data set showed that it was about 200,000 kilometers. We've increased it by 100,000. But to counter that, there was also a really sobering surprise. We try to identify with a high degree of spatial accuracy where these roads are. What I mean by that is we should identify where they are within 50 meters if we're in the mountains and within 200 meters if they're in flatland. And we've only been able to do that for 3% of the roads.
all of the 300,000 kilometers of roads that are in our data set, they are Roman roads. They are attested by sources of some form or other, but only for 3% do we have an accuracy below 200 meters. That was really a very surprising realization, because it means despite 200 years of research on roads of the Roman Empire, our knowledge of its precise location is really still in its infancy.
It sounds pretty intuitive, but I mean, how did people navigate the system of roads? Did they have maps at the time?
There are a sort of maps. In a way, the Romans had maps. There are travel documents, ancient travel itineraries. How you should imagine this is kind of like a roadmap that tells you, so you want to move from Cadiz in the south of Spain to Rome? Well, then you need to take the Via Augusta. And you first go from this town to this town over the road, and then from this town to this town. So it's kind of telling you, like a GPS, these are the roads you follow.
So, Tom, earlier you mentioned the famous Via Appia, the Appian Way. How many of these roads, or I should probably say their footprint anyway, are today still the pathways into the Italian capital?
So in Italy, there are still a lot of areas where you can see the ancient roads and where the modern roads follow the ancient roads. But it's not just in Italy. It's throughout the entire empire, throughout all of Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East. We see a huge amount of continuity in where roads are in the last 2,000 years. And that's mind-boggling. What we've noticed is that there's a moderate positive correlation between where Roman roads are and where major modern roads are. This means that if you're driving with a car in Europe on a highway, chances are you're very close to a Roman road.
Tom Ruchmans is a professor of classical archaeology at the University of Aarhus in Denmark, telling us about his research into the extensive ancient network of roads in the Roman Empire. Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's almost 40 days now. The U.S. government shutdown is bringing financial pain, not just to federal employees here in this country, but also to some foreign employees working overseas. This includes staff at American military facilities. Last month, the government in Germany agreed to pay some of the 11,000 local hires, people who work on U.S. military bases there, Germans and other non-Americans. They've also had their pay suspended during the shutdown. But other countries like Portugal are not stepping in to help their citizens caught up in this U.S. political drama. More than 400 residents on the island of Terceira in the Azores, the autonomous Portuguese islands in the Atlantic, they continue to work for the U.S. military at the Lages Air Base there without pay. Paula Terra is the president of the Portuguese Workers' Representative Committee at the base and spoke with us earlier today from Terceira.
This year, for the first time, and due to the U.S. federal government shutdown, we have almost 400 employees with delayed salaries. And this was the first time that ever happened to the local civilians. We've been through situations of government shutdowns before, but this year, for some reason, this was applied to the local nationals.
What do you do at the base?
So I'm a fleet specialist, so I do fleet managing for all the vehicles and equipment that we have here at the Lodges Field.
And how is it that you're working right now? I mean, shouldn't you be on furlough?
Yes. So that's the thing. Because furlough is not foreseen on our bilateral agreements, there is nothing that will justify us being at home. We would have to have some type of justified absence on the regulations. And because this is a new situation that we're in, the information that we have is that we need to report to work. So we're reporting to work. We're still submitting our time cards as normal. And eventually, you know, when the shutdown ends, we're hoping that we're going to get our back pay.
Yeah. So help us understand what you've been going through since the shutdown over a month ago. When was the last time you received a paycheck?
So the last time we received a paycheck was on the beginning of October. And on that paycheck, we noticed that we were missing 4 days. So starting on the 1st of October, we entered on that same furlough status that is applied to the DOD civilian employees. And we asked the government of Lisbon to consider advancing these delayed payments to the employees. But unfortunately, the mainland government, they were concerned, but there was no solution coming from them. So then we turned to the Azorean government. And at this point, the Azorean government is putting together some procedures so the employees, starting Monday, can have access to social security funds and at least have some of those delayed payments paid to the employees.
Well, as with everybody impacted by this government shutdown, I mean, at the end of the day, this is about people's livelihoods. How closely are you following the news about this there in the Azores?
You know, we are following the news every day, every single day. We even have a group chat so we can know, you know, is there going to be any voting today or not? What were the results? What's the probability of the bills being approved? Because this is really concerning. And us as local nationals, we should not be going through this stress, because this had a big impact. Like you were saying, it's almost 40 days of government shutdown. And it has been causing great financial stress among the workers and their families.
What is the history of the Lajes base? How long has it been on the island of Terceira in the Azores, and how important is it for the local economy?
So this base is here since 1946, 47, I believe. So the island is really small. So we have, I would say, around 60,000 people. And the base is the second biggest employer on the island, the first one being the local hospital. And the base, so that this has a big impact on the local economy, you know, as many families, you know, are unable to meet their regular expenses. They cannot support local businesses. So, you know, everything's connected.
I know, Paola, that some government employees who are not being paid in this shutdown have taken a second job. How will you make ends meet if the shutdown continues?
I don't know. Starting Monday, we'll benefit from these social security funds. But if this situation takes longer, then I can't say. People would have to take leave without pay, for example, and find a different job. But even if you're going to find a different job, your payment is only going to come on the end of that month. So you actually have to find something that will give you a daily payment. If not, then, you know, it won't be a solution for your problems. So we're kind of stuck here with the situation.
Paola Terra has been working without pay during the U.S. government shutdown at the Lajes Air Base on the island of Terceira in the Azores. We leave you today with some music from West Africa, from a duo that sadly is no longer a duo. Amadou and Mariam are known as the blind couple from Mali. Amadou Bagayoko died earlier this year, leaving his wife, Mariam Doumbia, to carry on alone, performing their joyous mix of West African blues and Afro-rock. Amadou's death came just as the couple had wrapped what would be their final recording together. L'amour à la folie, or Crazy Love, is the album's title track, continuing a beautiful tradition of declaring their love to each other in song. I want to rewind, though, to another, perhaps more relevant tune Amadou and Mariam recorded some years ago. This goes back to 2004. They wrote the song Politique Amanyi along with the reggae star from Côte d'Ivoire, Chiken Dja Fakoly, and French-Spanish artist Manu Chao. The subtitle of the song in French is La politique, c'est pas bon. Politics aren't good. When this number was composed, corruption among Mali's democratically elected politicians was the main concern. Some 20 years later, the lyrics that spoke to the violent side of politics seem prescient, as an al-Qaeda splinter group is now poised to take over Mali's capital, Bamako. The four musicians weave their message between French, Bambara, and English. It is a protest song about the political status quo, with an infectious rhythm as only Amadou and Mariam, along with Chiken Dja Fakoly and Manu Chao, could deliver. Politique, Mariam Doumbia, by the way, she's touring North America starting today through the 18th of this month. Check your local listings. The World comes to you Monday through Friday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a relaxing weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.